I'm very happy to be here. Thank you for coming out. I know it's the end of your semester or whatever you call it here, and I know that's a time of fatigue and dispersion. So I'll try and pull a lot of things together for you. And thank you for that introduction. It somehow put me at ease. Being talking about teachings is a very natural role for me. And so I want to start by saying something directly to the younger scholars in the room. The reference to my work in Bhopal is kind of in the background of what I'll present here, but it's good to think with, because I want you to think about how common and given it is that we need to study and theorize globalization. When I was in the field, I was in the field between 1989 and 1991 in India, globalization was not an object of concern. It wasn't an idiom that we knew how to speak. And so doing ethnographic work that elicits language for emergent phenomena, I think, is a really critical responsibility that we have as scholars. And you'll see that continue in my work here. And it begs all kinds of questions about ethnographic method, how we do it, how we collaborate in doing it, and how we theorize. And just the teaching volume that was just referred to, Field Methods in a Time of Transition, or whatever it's called, there's another volume just now going to press called Theory Isn't What It Used to Be. And so I think everything is up, and I think you'll see that in the work I describe here. So I've titled my talk here, Experiments in Environmental Public Health, Scientific, Political, Ethnographic, Digital. And what I want to get at with the experiment is that in trying to document and analyze, observe environmental health phenomena, we are trying to design our own knowledge project in a way responsive to what we observe and critique. And that's where the experiment lies. And I start with this slide of a schoolyard with swings sitting just on the fence line of a chemical plant. This is in the city of Houston, where I happen to grow up. It has no zoning, but across the United States, we cite schools right adjacent to high-risk facilities. And it's interesting to me as a cultural anthropologist, because it makes sense to somebody, to some organizations, to do so. And so the problem in politics of sense-making is really at the core of the project that I'll describe. Move this so I can actually see you. And the corollary is that if it makes sense to cite schoolyards in this way, what doesn't make sense in dominant orders of meaning and representation? And that's really at the core of this project, the Asthma Files Project. So the Asthma Files Project is many years in the making, and it has a lot of different dimensionality. It's really designed to nest projects side by side and within other projects. And it's experiment in bringing ethnographers together collaboratively. And I'm sure all of you who work anywhere near ethnography know the challenge of that. It is a bit like herding cats, but with purpose, because we're trying to design projects that get at the problem of atomized knowledge that is so centrally a problem in environmental health. And so the one way to articulate the organizing question of the project as a whole is what works for and against apprehension of asthmatic subjects. And by asthmatic subjects, I mean subjects that are, by definition, complex, politically laden. There's a lot of forces, cultural and political, economic, that work against the sensibility of these kinds of problems. And I think air pollution and asthma are sentinel conditions of this sort. So the more empirical question is, what kind of actants have air pollution and associated health impacts become? How have they moved knowledge and governance and come to characterize space? And I'll just point you to the literal definition of apprehension, because I use this, this word purposely. So to apprehend is to understand both cognitively and emotively. It's got a wide perceptual field, but it also means to take into custody, to capture. So there's a sense of governance, capturing a problem so that you can attend to it. But importantly, apprehension is something that comes with fear and trembling. And so the humility of recognizing that the paradigms at hand aren't adequate to the problems that we're dealing with is at the center of both what we want to observe and cultivate in our own practice. The Asthma Files is a project designed with purpose to look at asthma and asthma understood as an index of environmental health more generally, to look at it from many different angles, starting with the presumption that dominant ways of thinking about environmental health aren't apprehending the problem. And so one stream of our work, it actually started as a project in the Anthropology of Science. So we started looking at how scientific practitioners from many different fields, from a pediatric pulmonologist to an air chemist to a geneticist, apprehended asthma, looking just to understand different constructs of etiology, different kinds of evidence drawn upon to make sense of it. We also have another way into the material is through asthmatic spaces, primarily urban areas, but the set of shared questions we use to query that could be used at any scale. And so what shapes the dynamics of environmental health in a given space? And I'll share in just a moment, we're about to really, really animate that thread of work in the project. We also, the other kind of axes through it, so we have a thread of questions about that we share across projects in how is asthma governed? And we come at it asking, how can we as anthropologists and historians of science in particular ask questions about the role of science in governance in the contemporary period and with reference to environmental health in particular? And then another important mode is modes of care. And one of the things I hope I'll convey is that knowledge, care, governance gets very tangled together, because the question of governance is centrally tied to the production and use of science. Many of the scientists we study, they reach scientifically because they care about a problem that their available methods aren't yet addressing. This is the just a snapshot that suggests the genealogy that the project comes from. In the history and anthropology of science, the recognition that what counts as science, how science is organized and practices, changes in different times and places. And what I'll get to by the end of the talk is I think we're at a moment when we are documenting a fundamental shift in what counts as scientific practice, a shift that we can both document and I think critically participate in. And it's a shift that has potential to allow us to address contemporary injury, and particularly those that come with environmental health problems in particular. I want to call to mind, and this comes back to my opening statements, this is the critical literature that informs many of us in the project, although there's people working from many different traditions. Post-colonial studies, feminist studies of science, and the literature on risk. I expect most of these particular texts are familiar to you, but what I want to highlight here is many of these texts that are still foundational and extremely productive for our analysis and many others, they were written in the mid-1980s. And so the question is, what does this contemporary moment ask of us theoretically? What is it? How can we extend from this into new theoretical formulations? And so this is one quote from historian of science Evelyn Fox Keller, does wonderful feminist history of science, where she says that in her studies of developmental biology, she highlighted that not only is explanatory pluralism empirically observable in biology, but it's actually a productive difference. And what she says is explanatory pluralism is now not simply a reflection of differences in epistemological culture, but a positive virtue in itself, representing our best chance of coming to terms with the world around us. And so by design, our project tries to animate this explanatory epistemological pluralism, both among ethnographers, really leveraging the way hermeneutic analysis draws out difference of interpretation, but with potential also to thread humanities and social science kind of analyses into the analyses of people in other scientific fields. So I'll just say quickly a little bit about how we came to the project and about some of our recent collaborators. As was mentioned, I work in the anthropology of science, but I started at the site of the Bhopal disaster, so in many ways a more traditional anthropological study. The image on the left is an image of the board posted to look for victims in the aftermath of the Bhopal disaster. It's been an important image for me because a recurrent question in my research is what kind of information and data systems allow problems to be visible and accessible, and clearly this one is not adequate to the task at hand. The image on the with the red circles is from my research moving to look at toxic chemical risk in the United States. Each of those red circles is a facility with a worst case potential, like the Bhopal disaster in India, along the Mississippi River between New Orleans and Baton Rouge. We know from Hurricane Katrina that this is an area with great risk for extreme weather events. So just the coupled risk you see there is extraordinary. And I would argue that in our what I would term late industrial times, the layering of risk is really at in an extraordinary intensity. And that's one of the real calls for greater collaboration. But the guy on the mid-right, Barry Leffer, is an air chemist who has made it his career to do source apportionment of air pollution. And this was an important shift in my own research direction from fast to what could be called slow disaster, the even harder to see chronic pollution that percolates across fence lines. So people like Barry have been the people I've studied ethnographically. Also signaled on the right is a slide from toxicologists I study. Among toxicologists, there is not all, for sure. In fact, about 80 to 90% of toxicologists in the U.S. work for industry. So there's a political economy of knowledge production. But toxicologists at the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency for about the last decade have really been invested in a paradigm shift in knowledge production, recognizing that the old way, a very careful way of doing toxic studies with rat studies, et cetera, is just too slow for the problem at hand. And so I've selected my interlocutors largely based on those that are restless with their own disciplinary practice, because this is where I can capture them trying to apprehend in new ways. This is a slide showing Mike's development as a scholar, and he's actually trained as a historian of science. He's always worked in the contemporary period, so kind of lives more with cultural anthropologists. But his work is in the history of genetics, and particularly in the history of biology, and particularly interest history of genetics. His dissertation was on the U.S. Human Genome Project, but his current work focuses on the emergent work in gene-environment interactions. And this slide suggests where our work comes together that was really foundational for the Asthma Files project. On the upper right is a researcher who we've interviewed or known for a very long time that followed her work for the project, named Roz Wright. She's a pulmonary physician, but also runs a big asthma cohort study. She first in Boston, now she's added one in the Manhattan area. But what was of interest to us is she had this really quite crazy study design trying to integrate genetic factors, environmental factors of various kinds, all oriented to try and understand health disparities. So she wanted biomarkers of stress, of living in violent neighborhoods, combining it with genetics, combining it with environment. So just an incredibly impressive attempt to apprehend health disparities and poverty incidents. On the bottom right, this is EPA toxicology data, where each of those pie charts is a different kind of scientific data about toxic burdens, clinical chemistry, exposure data, genetic data of various kinds. And this kind of attempt to aggregate and use data and configure data in new ways is, I think, what's happening in the sciences and what we're trying to mime and contribute to in an ethnographic work. I'm going to say just a little bit about a couple of projects that have come out of the ASMA files, because I think that it will give you a sense of how the overarching project has supported a lot of different threads. One of the things we're really aware of as ethnographers is that it's not only people love their own projects, but for good reasons. If part of good ethnography is developing methods appropriate to the material that you're working with, it's hard to be tethered to others. And so that kind of, we've tried to have a study design that allows that kind of differentiation and collectivity. So it's an experiment in collectivity, among other things. So this is a former student, she's now an assistant professor at Drexel University in Philadelphia, that her dissertation focused on different modes of asthma care. She studied the Breathmobile, which is this van that drives around and provides asthma care in low-income neighborhoods in Los Angeles. Importantly, it leaves its motor running all day long in front of these schools. For me, it indexes the way incredibly passionate biomedical providers, school nurses, etc., are often completely unattentive to air pollution as a driver of what they're looking at. And part of what I'll try and show you is what we're interested in is in expanding what counts as care for asthma. So the Breathmobile is a ripe contradiction. She also has work on the new array of asthma apps. So information is flooding into asthmatic subjects and querying what does that do to the experience and ability to care for asthma. And on the bottom is a shot of a now very expensive way to care for asthma in the U.S. that actually originated in the Soviet Union, and it's where you control or almost hold your breath to control your asthma. So it understands the disease in a very different way than opening airways. But the presumption is that you're breathing too much is what causes the problem. So the kind of, if you Google Boteco, all the images are people holding their nose. And one of the things we've tried to get at is really fundamentally different understandings of the etiology of asthma. Another student, Brandon Costello-Kuhn, focused on the environmental information systems developed to understand air quality. On the left is the EPA's CMAQ, Community Multiscale Air Quality Model, an incredible open model where it's used all over the world and people contribute modules. So an extraordinary example of collaboration to understand air quality. And it's from this model that you get things like daily ozone readers. So it's a real, both these projects were done on the science side of EPA, not the policy side. There's also scientists on the policy side, but the question of where science gets done, how that shapes the science, how that shapes its movement into policy, is a question that we share. And this is a project that is just being completed as a dissertation, understanding Tehran and Iran as an asthmatic space. Lots of limitations on access because of political conditions in Iran. But Iran has, of the 10 top cities documented by the World Health Organization as the worst cities for air pollution in the world, I think 4 are in Iran, and it doesn't even include the capital of Tehran. One of the wonderful data sets that Sonia Tahereh-Saheb formed was, despite really, really quite extraordinary limits on expression in Iran today, in the mainstream conservative newspaper, there has been a really rich set of political cartooning about air pollution. One of the things we've learned to ask to characterize different asthmatic spaces is what modes of critique are available. are established or emergent in order to give articulation to emergent problems. And then this is a project which I'm pretty sure we are about to get funded for by the U.S. National Science Foundation, which is to study environmental health governance in six cities: Beijing, Bangalore, New York City, Houston, Philadelphia, and Albany. And really what we're trying to get at here is, how can we see differences in the way science has been cultivated to understand the problem? How has it moved through different sectors of governance? An important part of the project is transportation in particular. So the kind of nodes are environment, health, transportation, and education. And what we're trying to understand is, can we learn to characterize signature modes of environmental health governance? So we're just beginning this thread of the work. Okay, so the asthma files, since tomorrow the workshop really focuses on the logic and the design of the digital platform, I'm just going to say a little bit about it today. But what we call the design logics really drives the organization of our work. And what I think you'll see just visually here is that a lot of the logic is supporting this the pluralization of perspective on a complex phenomena. And the design logics is really where we've tried to move our theoretical understanding of the way language and knowledge work that we learn both from the history of science and from critical theory into research design and technical functionality. And we can come back to these. We also have what we call substantive logics, which is literally a running list of why it's important to do the project now in this historical juncture. And we keep this list because of commitment to doing scholarship that is, as Michi said, tuned to the historical moment. And so to always ask, why this project now? Why ask this question at this stage? And so using the political not just as an end, but as a driver of a research imagination. This is a simple and rather obvious logic. Asthma incidence is considered at epidemic rates around the world, with huge disparities in developed countries. In the left here, you see like the Puerto Rican community in the US, huge outliers. The map on the right is quite dated. You may have noticed just in the last year or two, air pollution has really, really risen as an object of media attention. Importantly, the World Health Organization is recognizing it as a health stressor at a new level, and also recognizing that it will change the way they've done business for the last couple of decades. It's not infectious disease. It's going to be a new order of things. And we're interested in that kind of organizational transition called for. Another substantive logic or reason for the project, as I mentioned before, an extraordinarily restricted sense of care in a dominant idiom, where the medication-compliant individual is seen as the way to fix the problem. And this slide is kind of like in the background, kind of pushing the project forward. It's also an important, asthma has been a really wonderful place to work because of what I would call methodological humility among the scientists working on asthma. And so there's a real openness to both being interviewed by us, but also collaborating with us. Just in the last 5 to 10 years, there's been a number of kind of Lancet-style special issues saying, whoa, we probably don't, asthma's not what we think it is. Is it a lot of different conditions? Have we been monolithic, et cetera? And importantly, the technology has supported this. The new kind, microarrays, all these new kinds of technologies they're using in asthma sciences has differentiated what asthma is, so adding ever more layers of complexity. And then this is just a slide to suggest that the need for research that pushes back against a very restricted way of educating people about asthma. This is one of my favorite things to point to because this is an EPA educational booklet for children, and pollution, outdoor air pollution, isn't even on the list of potential drivers. And when I ask about this, the answer was, Well, it was made by the people in indoor air. And so just the extraordinary segmentation of attention and coordination in these enterprises is extraordinary. Okay, so this is the way the ASMA files is designed as a project, where we really try and look at very, very different ways of thinking about ASMA and lay them side by side. What we talk about is a juxtapositional logic. And really the ambition is to think in new ways about ASMA by kind of watching them in kaleidoscopic fashion. I'm just going to show you a couple of the older sets of material in the project to give you a sense of where we've been. This is one of the first, or I guess it was ASMA file one, that originally came from my research on how informatics was shaping the environmental field. African-American environmental justice group in Upper Manhattan partnered with university researchers and did these maps to show incidents of emergency room admissions for asthma, how they could be linked to diesel burdens, and particularly where the buses in Manhattan refueled. And it's an extraordinary study because it led to very concrete changes in the way buses were taken care of and moved through the city. So a different early asthma file from Mike's research. One of the things he's followed is the way asthma genetics has moved from a search for an asthma gene, a very singular sense of the role of genetics, to interest in an array of genes in a very refined sense that there's no simple story in the genetics connection. This is a file that explores how microarrays have enabled understanding of asthma, and as I suggested earlier, part of what a genetic expression analysis has done is allowed researchers to differentiate types of asthma based on genetic difference, where in the lungs the exacerbation is happening, and so it's one of the things I think you see across very data-intensive sciences is the ability to make difference, to see difference at a very fine granularity, and figuring out what to do with that knowledge in science as well as in policy, I think, is challenging. Another file pointing to Mike's research on gene-environment interactions, and what he's particularly interested in is changes in the way geneticists think about and carry out their research as they try and apprehend very indirect causality and clustered cumulative effect. This is a German researcher, Erika von Mucius, who's had deserved prominence for her work on asthma. And part of, she's known for something called the hygiene hypothesis, which provides an explanation of why, well, one of the first passes was looking at why you still have higher asthma incidence in West Germany than East Germany, and the connection being in part to early childhood exposures, either to farm environments or to daycare environments, and that having some kind of partial genetic explanation. So again, an important contribution to the understanding of the etiology of asthma. And this is a very different kind of file. This was a lot of these files are what we think of as staccato, just quick analyses to map the field. This is a poster contest run by the American Academy of Allergy, Asthma, and Immunology, which is an enormous professional association, very well funded by the pharmaceutical industry. And they run a poster session every year to reward children for good asthma behavior. What was interesting to me in this set of posters is every single poster, the good asthma behavior was the compliant asthma subject taking your medication. There was no mobilization of air pollution activism, for example. Okay, and I'll just show you now a couple of the things that were that we have on our desk right now. We've just started following the research of this very young researcher. He's an assistant professor at the University of Texas, Austin, and he's been riding around with auto rickshaw drivers in Delhi, counting particulate matter that these drivers experience every day, and the data is just staggering. But what he's very interested in connecting that street level data to global maps like this one, and so very strategically wanting to design his studies to have a public health impact. And one of the things we've learned is that connecting pollution science to health science, and particularly health public health advocacy, has been really, really slow to emerge. And so the way that scientists, I mean, they're doing basic science with an applied imagination, and so it's really reordering the basic applied differentiation. This is another set of research we're following, which is focused on the way that climate change, where it will is likely to exacerbate asthma in many different ways, from everything from more heat equals more pollen days to more heat equals ozone exacerbations, like is shown here. And then there's work like this, which is, this is out just in the last week or so, connecting air pollution to dementia. One of the, there's been an array of studies that connect air pollution to things other than respiratory ill health. And again, that that kind of complicates the picture in a way that's directive but challenging. And in, as this image on the lower left suggests, the World Health Organization is waking up and taking notice, and we're at a real stage of figuring out what that looks like organizationally. And importantly, organizations like the World Health Organization, the EPA, are calling researchers from the humanities and social sciences into the discussions in what I observe to be a really new way, because there is a there's an understanding of what of the cultural as well as organizational shifts called for. This is another project that we're watching now. It will be furthered in our study of Houston in the Six Cities study. What you see in the back is a real-time ozone map that was put together by an air chemist, the one you saw at the beginning, Barry Leffer, and a very, very good analytic philosopher who's just interested in knowledge politics. But what this is, this is a very bad ozone day in the image. It's relatively rare that it's that bad in Houston, although Houston has a very, very bad air quality burden. But what's interesting here is that Texas is very much governed by the petrochemical industry, as is its state agencies. There's a minor war ongoing between the state level Department of Environmental Quality and the EPA. And so the state has hired researchers to contest the emerging ozone standards in the U.S. And it's and it's serious politics, trying to, serious politics funding science. And it's a and this kind of imbrication of commercial interest in what we know about environmental problems, I think, is critical to understand at every stage. And this case puts it very much on the surface. It's often not as on the surface as it is here. This is another way that commercial interests are imbricated in knowledge production about the environment. Baytown is one of the petrochemical towns near Houston. It's actually where my father grew up, so I know it well. At the ExxonMobil refinery there on the left is the biggest refinery in the United States. But Bayer, your own Bayer, funds a program in Baytown County to reach every K-12 science teacher, providing them science education. So they're teaching the science teachers how to teach the science in the area around Baytown. So again, it goes, the imbrication of commercial interest goes all the way down. And so I want to pull this together by asking a question that many of us are habituated to ask in post-colonial studies is, you know, can't, I've got to some slides with a life of their own. Can asthma and air pollution speak? And some of you will hear this as a morph of the question of can the subaltern speak? And with the subaltern signifying that which literally can't be represented in dominant modes of representation. And it's important that the subaltern, it's not that she can't speak, she can't be heard. She's not legible in dominant orders of meaning. And I think that if we understand asthma, air pollution, environmental public health in those terms, it gives us some analytic advantage in entering the effort to apprehend these issues. At the bottom is a quote from Homi Bhabha, another post-colonial theorist some of you may know, and he argues that the phenomena of the post-colonial makes ambivalent what we have thought to be knowledge. And I think, again, you could put asthma and air pollution in that place. And so I want to give you some argument as to why I think that environmental health misses legibility so consistently. And this slide does kind of double work for me. It is a slide. All of these images are from the retired web presence of the American Chemistry Council, which is the trade group for the American chemical industry. It used to be called the Chemical Manufacturers Association, but that sounded a little too dirty, I think. So now they're the American Chemistry Council. But a few years ago, before the shale gas boom, which has given a whole new life to this industry and leavens all of this that I'm talking about, this was their advertising campaign, which was called Essential to the Chemistry. Industrial chemistry is essential to everything. And what was amazing, it was an incredibly deep web resource for students, for example, where you got the history of chemistry, how it contributed to health, building materials, everything. There was almost no mention of risk and adverse effects. And so the discursive strategy really was one of extraordinary positivity and just, and I've written about this as of just a disavowal, like kind of put everything else out of view. But importantly, I think that you can think about it in terms of an essentialist language ideology, where what counts as meaningful is in this very, very narrow frame, and what matters is within the bounds of attention, and what off-gases, what goes over the fence line, is literally not of concern. So the way that an essentialist language ideology and way of configuring knowledge undergirds industrial activity and what I would call industrial logic, I think is really, really foundational, or foundational is the wrong word, that it helps explains the illegibility of environmental health problems. And so this is a quote from Foucault that I think helps get at what I think that we're documenting and trying to present, participate in. He explains here that, I'll just read you the quote. I would define the episteme retrospectively as the strategic apparatus which permits of separating out from among all the statements which were possible, those that will be acceptable within, I won't say a scientific theory, but a field of scientificity, and which it is possible to say are true or false. The episteme is the apparatus which makes possible the separation not of the true from the false, but of what may or may not be characterized as scientific. And so what I want to suggest is that the new modes of science that we are documenting and trying to participate in are an emergent episteme that in many ways lack a language, lack discursive legitimacy, in part because of the political, economic, and cultural forces against their legibility. So I think it's it's an important historical juncture. This is one way that we visualize thinking about it using the an imagination provided by historian of science Peter Gallison, and he's looked at the different figurations of the scientists in different historical periods, in part driven by available technologies, and just a quick sense of the kind of analysis he does. is in the period before the camera, 1820, when the task of the scientist was to render a scientific representation, to draw it in its most perfect, ideal form. In 1820, when just literal reproduction, wrinkles and all, was what was considered a robust scientific rendering. So it's shift over time, and I think that through our study of environmental health, we can begin to characterize the kind of robust knowledge that is being reached for by the scientists and other people involved in response to environmental health, reach for that we and that we can reach for alongside of them. And I think that, I mean, you'll see that in the level of the persona, in the level of the persona, the figure of the persona beforehand, there is a kind of boldness to it. You have a genius or an expert rather than an apprehensive collaborator. And so the figure of knowledge production, I think, is really shifting. We can observe that ethnographically, but I think importantly, it has huge pedagogical implications. And so you see here the link between ethnographic analysis and pedagogy. Okay, and so this is another visual we've used that I think implicates both research design and teaching, which is if we're going to get at, apprehend environmental health problems, we need to animate and practice research that addresses all of these scales, and we lay them out alongside this sedimentation of fossil fuels to suggest that the traditional way of thinking about analysis in the humanities and social sciences, where you do the micro, meso, macro, just doesn't have the nuance that we need to get at the nature culture of the contemporary moment. And so you'll see at the bottom, as grounds, we have ecology, which I think there's been efforts to bring the ecological into political economy and cultural analysis for many years. You know, at the top, we put the Anthropocene, the kind of shifting world order. The if you think about it, the atmosphere isn't really captured in the ecological, conventionally conceived. It's not that it's not, but all of that needs to be attended to. And important here, and because this gets to teaching, is the way that we call the nano. There's something below the level of practice where the subjects who are tolerant or not with complexity, who have apprehension, both the concern about and trembling over the things that they're trying to respond to. And so this is, and we literally have moved from our ethnographic work into pedagogic work. And so we do things like move from what we're trying to learn ethnographically. And this is the kind of thing that we tried to build into the pedagogical parts of the project. You know, so for example, in students, multiplying the frames and idioms people have for making sense of things, locating rigor in labile structures of meaning. And what I think that is interesting here as a pedagogical goal is that there's not an assumption of knowing what, there's a deep commitment to developing people who can collaborate going forward many years, rather than teaching, there's no answer now, teaching a capacity to reach for answers. And so this, I'll just conclude by talking briefly about the projects that we have spun off of the Asthma Files work, again, trying to be responsive in our own practice to what we're observing ethnographically. So the Asthma Files started as a kind of old-fashioned research project on a very, very, very large PowerPoint that where we tried to array these analyses alongside each other. As you can imagine, it crashed in many different kinds of ways. So it's led to our investment in the development of the platform for experimental collaborative ethnography. So the development of digital infrastructure to support collaboration among us as ethnographers and potentially us with the scientists we studies and with others, other subjects of asthma. And I'll talk more about this tomorrow, but what one of the things we've learned is that the way that digital infrastructure and data production capacity is configured matters enormously, and it matters for us as well. So, for example, we've spent much of this summer arguing over and trying to get right the data model behind the Peace Platform. And it reminds me of when I went to do work in Bhopal, I never thought I'd have to learn how to read the diagram of the piping configuration in the plant. I thought that was someone else's job. But the way this kind of work implicates you in the technology in a really deep way is important. And then the other thing that I'll just point to is that another spinoff is something we call the Disaster STS Network. And that's where we've said, the Disaster STS Network runs on the Peace Platform, but importantly, it's not a research project. It's an effort to network researchers working on both fast and slow disaster. Slow disaster like the global asthma epidemic. And it's interesting empirically because I think the social contract involved in being involved in a research network is different than being involved in a project, and we're trying to figure that out and support that technically. But it's a spinoff from the asthma project because it's really meant as a place to network researchers so that they're more available for emergent practical events. Because in disaster work, you know, there's a lot to be said about this. There's a real slide between practitioners researchers. We've also just begun to conceptualize an instance of the Peace Platform that would be for people with chronic illness. And the idea is not only to give them opportunities to archive and take care of the extraordinary amounts of documentation that you deal with with chronic illness, but to build into it a capacity for ethnographic reflection on the encounters that you have as a person with chronic illness. We also have a program that moves our findings into teaching of very young children. This is my undergraduate students teaching the air quality index to 7 and 8 year olds. And again, what we've learned is the effort to translate across generation is an interesting kind of collaboration in itself. And our pedagogical goal here is to teach complex causation to 7-year-olds. And what's amazing, it's really possible. It's just often not attempted. And also, as mentioned earlier, I have taught research design to PhD students for many years. And I think a lot of what we learned from the asthma project is we need a lot of projects that are reaching for the kind of complexity and collaboration that we're getting at. And I'll just give you a hint of, I start with this image because I ask my students to think about what they see, and if they see any more, if they know that all of these images came from a children's book called Alphabet City. And so the way that theory shapes, allows you to see, but also once you see it as alphabets, you don't see anything else. So the way that theory both provides insight and blinds. And one reason you need what we think of as kaleidoscopic perspective is precisely because of that double bind. You need the expertise, the theory that sharpens what you see, but in very so doing, things are cut from view. And we invite collaborators to do more things within the project, but also on the edges of the project. This was a conceptualized but never performed a project between a projection artist and a dancer to convey the many determinations of the asthmatic experience through the body of a dancer. And she's wearing a white coat, and the projection was to be on her, on the wall behind her, in the sense of how can you effectively convey complex scientific claims of the sort the asthma files highlights. And then so I'll close with this image, which is an important ethnographic artifact for me. So if you look at the figure on the right, the figure of a wise man, and then turn your head to the left. This way. in English. Do you, you're seeing both? Okay. This illusion is on the website for kids of the U.S. National Institute of Health, National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences, that I'll point out gets only 2% of the NIH budget. This is where environmental health counts politically, economically in the U.S. science apparatus. And they use it, they provide a lovely website for kids, but this set of illusions is to point to the way science is about separating truth from illusion. And I think I love the work of NIEHS, but I think this gets at the failure of language and imagination for thinking about what science is. Because if science, if it is as simple as it's true or it's not true, then we got a real problem in dealing with environmental health. And so the language of robust science that can convey our production and use of that science, I think is really needs to be animated and can be by the kind of research done in our field. And so I oppose the kind of figure of the wise man to a kaleidoscope, which has been an important image in the asthma files, where if you think of a kaleidoscope, it brings a lot of different colors together and you can spin it. And so trying to organize a project and digital platform where you really can look at a problem one way, look at it a different way, and turn that into productive insight and action. So I end with toward kaleidoscopics. Thank you.